My name is David Bella, and today's session will be on hope in the nuclear age. And I'm not going to plan it. I don't have a rigid agenda to present here. And I've done that on purpose because last week the best sessions we had occurred when we had some sort of discussion. And so some sort of questions and answers. Last week I did do a session on Star Wars and then some nuclear paradoxes. So if you have some questions on that, I can fill you in on what I know about that. What I'd like to do, though, today is address the issue of hope in the nuclear age, given the fact that there are some enormous problems out there in dealing with the nuclear question, and given the fact that none of us seem to have some nice clear-cut answers, and in fact there are some very strong disagreements, what is the meaning of hope given that situation? That's what we want to do. But before we get into the question of hope, I think we may want to share some of our experiences and the difficulties of even discussing nuclear issues, the question of the nuclear arms race, and a lot of the concepts such as nuclear deterrence and the weaponry and Star Wars and a whole bunch of other kinds of issues that come up. It seems to me that this topic becomes an extremely difficult one to talk about. And what I want to do is see if we can share some of those difficulties, why we have difficulties doing this, without having some sort of judgmental position right off the bat. Let me give you a few of my experiences on this. Some of them that were successful and some of them that weren't. I did teach a course last fall on the arms race, and I wanted to get engineers into this course. And one of the problems I have when I get engineers into the course is one of two things happens. They either take a very narrow view and say, wait a minute, that's too much. I don't want to deal with that. I want to deal with my little area of specialty. I don't know that. Or they take a broader view, and then they become very cynical. They say, ain't it awful? They become rather depressed. And it seems like they have those two choices. So I had a course in which we spent some time studying the arms race, and we had to struggle with this whole notion of hope, even when we were a bunch of engineers working on what you might call technical questions concerning the arms race. The question of hope always had to come into that, that whole topic. I can recall one discussion we had in fact, I think it was several years ago at Holden Village, and it was on the Catholic bishop's response, the letter that they made. And there was a criticism that the Catholic bishops, by one person, the Catholic bishops had discussed this with some of the experts in the administration. And, a few of us said, well, what kind of criticism is that? And they said, well, would Jesus have discussed it with Pilate? And that just ended the whole discussion. It just ended because then what happened, you see, the hidden message was, of course, if you disagree with me on who you're going to discuss, then you're really not a Christian. Okay? And then when you get into that kind of situation, you find a whole lot of people just keep their mouths shut and wait till the discussion's over and then just leave and then gripe about it later. So there are a lot of problems that the Christian community as well as the non-Christian community have in discussing this issue. In some cases they divide, become very polarized, and I think you've experienced that. In other cases, people just become very depressed, and as a teacher that's very difficult because as people become cynical and depressed, they become less effective in dealing with the world. So we have to deal with the concept of hope. Now, there's a very good reason why it's important for the citizenry, and I include the churches in that, to deal with these topics. If we don't deal with those topics, then what happens is the experts who are within large-scale organizations they do the best they can and they make their decisions. Well, we've had some warnings about large organizational complexes. Can anybody remember one of the warnings we've had about the military-industrial complex? Remember who gave that warning about
Eisenhower.
Dwight Eisenhower. Okay. Now, Dwight Eisenhower was Republican. He was a military man, a general, president of the United States. And in his farewell address, he warned about the military-industrial complex. Now, you would think that would be a very strange thing for him, you know, giving his background to warn about. He also, in that same speech, warned about listening to the experts too much and becoming dominated by the experts. And he also warned, for those of us who are in universities, about what could happen to universities. They would stop asking questions and instead pursuing funds and dollars. That has really happened. It's a profound talk, a little speech in his farewell address. And historians have thought, well, Eisenhower really didn't mean that. You know, he was this nice old guy. Probably some speechwriter just put that in and he just read it off. That is not the case. The historians are now going back, and there's what is known as the revisionist historians, and they're going back and finding out that Eisenhower had some very definite views on that. And they're finding this by interviewing people and also seeing the notes on the drafts of the speech. And it turns out that his little notes are in there on this, on how to change the speech, and they're interviewing some of the people. He felt very strongly about this. I talked with Herbert York several weeks ago. I was at a workshop, and Herbert York was a science advisor. He had known Eisenhower and spoke with him after this speech. And he asked him about this, the two warnings. He said two. I said, well, don't forget the one about the universities, about the military-industrial complex, and about relying too much on the experts. And Herbert York said Eisenhower's response was, well, those were the two most important things I had to say, and I wanted to say them, and then just with the rest of the speech, just fill in. So it's kind of the opposite of what people thought, that, you know, the main part of the speech they thought was really Eisenhower, and somebody slipped in these other warnings, but actually it seems to be the other way around. Eisenhower was deeply concerned. I've done some research on large-scale organizational systems. And one of the things I find is they have a tremendous capability to distort information, even though the people in those organizations are honest people, honest, sincere people. They can still distort information, and I think we can look in the history of the church even, and we can see that large organizations do that. So what is essential then, I've concluded, very much along the same line as Eisenhower did, is you do have to have an outside citizenry raising the tough questions. Or what happens is, in the organization, those kinds of questions that tend to disrupt the organization, what happens to those questions?
Buried.
They get buried, they get lost, they get forgotten. And those kinds of beliefs and perceptions that sustain the organization, what happens to them? They rise to the top and they get sustained. And if the citizenry don't challenge the people who claim to be experts, then the organizations are the ones who determine who the experts are and what they say. They may be very sincere people, but how did they get picked and the 100 would-be experts not picked? Well, what happens is they tend to say, even though they believe it, the kinds of things that fit the organizational needs, and so therefore they rise to the top. So it becomes extremely important that the citizenry participate in these discussions. And when they asked Eisenhower about what he thought, how can we solve the problem of the military-industrial complex, he said, only an alert and informed citizenry can deal with that problem. There's another way of looking at it. We look on the Soviet Union as a totalitarian state. And I think it is. There's a large-scale organizations in the Soviet Union that control the free press, control what goes on in the school system, control the information. It's a very controlled society, and it's more difficult for the citizenry to publish independent views and to lead debates and so forth and so on. So we call this a totalitarian state. It restricts the dissemination of contrary ideas, unpopular ideas, at least unpopular in terms of the government, and we're proud of the fact that we have a pluralistic society, a democratic society, a free society, where people are able to raise these questions and able to go ahead and challenge dominant views. However, if the people don't do that, then there really isn't that much difference between a totalitarian state and one that is so-called free state. You see? If one doesn't let you raise the questions, okay, and the other one, you just don't do it even though they do let you, I'm not sure there's that much difference. Okay? So if you raise these questions and people question your patriotism, say, well, hey, wait a minute, I thought we belonged in a society where these questions could be raised. If we don't raise these questions, then we become the functional equivalent of a totalitarian state. Okay, but given that little introduction, it is extremely difficult still to raise the issues and to discuss them. And I'd like to right now just kind of throw it open to the group out here. What are some of the difficulties you've found in discussing, you know, dealing with questions of the arms race? Okay, some of you.
I think one of them is just the area of patriotism. And then you question the building the Annex missile.
Right.
We don't need that. Then they say, you really don't want the United States to be stronger than the Soviets. You want to be weak.
Okay.
And therefore you're not patriotic. Because
okay.
You question one of the that's a military aspect of what
right.
You're
looking
at. I think part of the problem is the diarrhea of information we have that tends to just swamp most people who are either sincere or intelligent enough mm-hmm. or concerned enough to want to solve the problem. That you get overwhelmed by both the information and the misinformation that gets passed along. And you may think, well, maybe we are okay. Maybe we've got plenty of missiles. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you're told, no, we really don't. And the same people will tell on this, the same, you know, there's just obviously X number of tangible missiles and X number of all this and that, but getting that information mm-hmm. that is not, I mean, getting it out so that people can use it properly is probably one of the most difficult things at all. I think there's some sincere people, as you say, that don't have any idea
right.
how many missiles are on them. Because in most cases, the military has to do a lot of protecting of its own mm-hmm. right, you know, its own areas. The Pentagon has its own particular flag to wave, and they're not about to give out the correct or the information that's not going to be beneficial to their budget.
Well, there's very pragmatic reasons for a lot of that, that failure to release a lot of information, of course, and that's related to the benefits of some military secrecy.
Oh yeah, I agree, but I'm not denying that that is a factor. I'm just saying that there's a lot of that, even sincere people, that can't get the information, but even in positions of power.
Okay, let's take the concepts here and see if we can, I'll paraphrase them, because we've got several of them together. One, I'm hearing you say there is a tremendous abundance of information or different information, and it's hard to sort through.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to sort through what information is secret for a good reason, what information is secret for an unjustified reason, what information is meaningless, or even when you have the numbers, because there are fairly good numbers out now, what do you mean? What does it mean when you see lists of this and lists of that, and how do you even interpret the information? Okay? So we do sense then that there is an information overload. Now, one of the things you'll find from the sociology of say, science or the sociology of technology is the importance of communities to sift through the information so that the, you know, there's some meaning given to that information, and so that you can throw out the information that is misinformation and preserve the kind of information that has some validity to it. That's the role of a community over time, and religious communities do the same thing. They function as a community. In other words, there's no information that just pops out and says, I am good information, and another one pops out and it says, I am bad information. It takes human communities in all areas of knowledge to discuss it, to bat it around, and expose, through their dialogue, the information that is misinformation, or invalid information, or weak information, and then to preserve that which is good information, trustworthy information, maybe not perfect, but at least better than the stuff they had before, right? So that, if you read in the sociology of knowledge, you find that, that's happened. That's why the problem you're raising here, where people won't discuss those things because it's unpatriotic, then that's related to the problem you raised, is we don't know what kind of information to rely on. Because if there aren't communities that are raising the questions, then one of the symptoms will be a confusion over the information. Okay. Just as though the scientists were out there collecting a whole lot of data, but they never got together to really discuss it. You'd have all these numbers flying, and they wouldn't know what to do with it. Okay? Science as a body of knowledge evolves because there is a dialogue within a community over time, and there's development of concepts, development of ideas. And if there isn't that community, that caring community, then what happens is people say, I don't know what to believe, and that's... Philosophers use different terms for that. Nihilism might be one of them. There's no way I can say this information is better than this information. Anything goes, and then all you have to do is choose up sides, and that's how they decide what information they're going to believe. Conservatives choose to believe this, the liberals tend to believe this, the pacifists tend to believe this, the other people tend to believe this, and they all get together and reinforce their own biases. Okay? That's the danger that we have when we don't have communities that can discuss things. Okay? Okay, yes?
Are we going to switch topics?
Yeah, go ahead.
The thing I think I'm most concerned about is, and I think it came up in June with the security leaks and the whole security system of information. I guess my greatest concern is that who decides that something such as a missile or a rocket ought to be launched, and how safely and securely is that system protected against some high school age kid who's a computer wizard who can just get into the system, send in, you know, and decide to play a practical joke, and all of a sudden we have somebody who has an order who launches a missile,
yeah,
and we're in a nuclear war.
Right. Okay, so the movie War Games is an example. How many have seen the movie War Games? Okay, so here a kid gets into it, and somehow he triggers a machine, a computer, that is programmed to play nuclear games. Okay, and what the computer does is start simulating a nuclear attack in the computers of the Defense Department. Now, that may sound bizarre. That actually happened several years ago, something quite close to that. They, of course, have to test these devices, and one way you do this with computers is you do simulations. You simulate an attack, and you go through training exercises. Well, somebody slipped in a training tape that went into the computers, the main computers, and they had a simulated attack occurring, and they went something like 6 minutes into an alert. You've got to realize 6 minutes may sound like a small amount of time, but you reach almost an irreversible trend, maybe 15 minutes or 20 minutes, because it only takes 30 minutes for the Soviet warheads to get from the Soviet Union to the United States. So that kind of problem actually, you know, came up. I talked to one person who had talked to the person who was supposed to call up Jimmy Carter at the time. I think it was during the Carter administration. And they got this information in, and they reported to them that all the information was consistent, that the Russians, the Soviets, were attacking. So he says, is there any inconsistent information? And they said, well, the political group, the group that's looking in on the Soviet Union says there's nothing going on. They're all home in bed. Okay? So he decided not to call up Carter and wait. And then they found out the tape was in there. So that's an interesting little story. That's a problem right now. How do they actually make the decisions? Who makes the decisions?
Well, the decision wasn't made, obviously.
The decision.
I mean, nobody launched.
Nobody launched, right. Right. Well, what's. You're right. What's. Follow up. What's the point? I'm trying to.
Well, it never got to the person who makes that decision to launch.
So you're saying the president makes the decision to launch?
Sure. The president makes the decision to release the weapons. A commander can launch on warning. Nobody launched. I mean, launching aircraft. Nobody launched any aircraft. I think we'd have heard about it.
So, I'm not, you know, I agree
well,
with you.
Well, there was a system, in other words, that protected the weapons from being released.
So you're saying, well, I'm
the
trying to
worked.
Get the...
That's what I'm saying.
So...
I mean, no aircraft were launched. No missiles started a countdown or anything like that.
Yeah, but the guy just... On a hunch, didn't launch him, sound like from what he said.
What do you mean, the guy?
Whoever you were talking about that didn't call first. Just his hunch that it was.
Yeah, there was, from what I gathered. Now, I didn't talk to the guy himself, so I'm giving third, but apparently this was the case that he said, well, I'll just wait. It was kind of a hunch.
If he'd followed all the instructions he was getting, he probably would have, should have launched it.
He might have. Well, not launched, he would have called the president.
Yeah.
But we never got to that point.
So the system worked.
So the system worked.
The safeguard, the fail-safe, whatever you want to call it.
Okay, now...
That time.
Okay,
sure.
What do we learn from that? See, we've got a system, you see. Here we've got an interesting thing to discuss right now. What does it mean to work and not work when you have to have a system that always must work? You see, you can't... Okay,
well, I think you have to move from that into almost into ideology and philosophy or ideas. In other words, that you can continue on this game, and what you will do, at least in every discussion, as you have suggested at the beginning, whether it's in a church meeting or what have you, you'll get into a kind of a battle of dealing with the mechanics and technology, which is critical, because
I
believe you could make a mistake. In other words, in spite of all of those controls, it's like shooting down a Korean airliner over the water. What reason was there, but someone pulled the trigger and down went.
I think
went,
that was a capricious act.
Pardon?
That was not
well,
a capricious
well,
act.
But I think, but it, to me, it's a very, very, it's a similar kind of situation.
Okay.
I think what...
Let's stick to this situation and see what happens, okay? This is good. Okay. So what you're saying, I'm confused.
What I want to move is from the givens and the realities to, I don't want to get into futures, to some extent that's a problem, but what it amounts to is somewhere or another going into the arena of ideas, because my feeling is that we are on somewhat opposing, of course, the ideologies are opposing. In other words, the free society against the totalitarian society, they're not going to come together in the technological area. They're going to come together, I think, in the area of ideas.
But I didn't hear the question that you raised as an ideological question. I heard the question, correct me on this. I heard the question is, how do we control these kinds of things? How does it get controlled?
Now my question is, what hope do we have if the only control we have is a system based on human beings who a month ago proved to us that our whole security system is full of holes, where we believed it was something.
So let me just phrase it another way, in a more general way, okay? Because I don't want to make it sound like we're accusing the American system of being really bad, because then it does become an ideological question. Let's put it this way. Where we have, we and the Soviets have highly complex technological systems that must respond within minutes, there's something scary about that. And how do we deal with that? Now, I think that is, we could phrase that as a non-ideological question, at least in a sense that the Soviets would have the same problem as we do in terms of the technology that's there and in terms of the kinds of command and control systems, because the implication is that we might have a war by accident. Is that the implication?
May I pose a question in this regard, and that is that I think that technology is inevitably pushing us toward more and more sophisticated weapons of this type. As soon as you recognize that your opponent, for example, has a certain capability, then in order to have a deterrent against that capability, obviously you have to develop something that's at least as capable, if not more so. I think that the major issue we face is that unless there is a curtailment in the need for the weapons in the first place, that we're going to face this issue ever more, and eventually, of course, we may face that terrible situation where a very sophisticated system is set up and does, in fact, operate autonomously rather than through direct human intervention. And I think we have to face up to the issue as to why are the weapons there in the first place, and what can we do about eliminating the weapons rather than worrying about whether they're very sophisticated. We will never prevent them from being sophisticated, and with time they will get more and more sophisticated.
Okay, now this is an interesting new sidelight, which I hear a non-tech, I'm going to play devil's push on this thing. Where I'm hearing a non-ideological statement that maybe ought to be challenged in the sense there's no way that we can stop this technological pushing. Is that what you were saying?
Yes.
Well, how do people feel about that? That somehow we've got a technological imperative and there's no way that we can stop that.
I think what she said about becoming more informed in the community and the people being aware of what's going on can stop that. And that's where I think there's hope.
But not on a technological basis, I don't believe.
No, no, no. What?
Technological basis.
Well, is technology immune from the discussions of the citizenry? That's what I'm pushing for.
Well, technology, in my mind, is moving far beyond the average mind and
cold military and political strategy.
I want to get on the technology in the sense, back there and then on.
Do you have any idea at all how many nations have nuclear bombs? How many individual nations have a stockpile or whatever? Produced bombs.
Well, the knowledge to produce bombs is different than whether they have a stockpile, because the knowledge to produce bombs is spreading rather rapidly. The number of nuclear weapons other countries have is actually way below the estimates that we thought would happen 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, there's what, about 6 or 7, depending how you count them. Like, for example, Israel, you don't know whether they haven't really tested one, but they think they have them. But I'd like to, so the proliferation hasn't been nearly as bad as the development of our own technology between the Soviet Union and the United States, overwhelming amount.
Why?
You just add up the total number of weapons that are there, the overwhelming amount are held by the Soviet Union and the United States.
I'm trying to get to it, and I think one of the reasons I say why, there was an expectation of that growth to take place. Mm-hmm. And because of the involvement of people, that ability was reduced because of their concerns.
Well, the one area where the Soviet Union and the United States have really been in agreement is on non-proliferation, and they've worked together on that. That's been one area they have worked together on. Now, whether that's been the case, or whether it's been other countries deciding, or whether it's just been too expensive for them to pursue, or they see that it would not help them, or they don't want to be part of the that I couldn't say. I would rather stick to our own technology, because I do find when we start discussing the third world, we start removing the problem from our own culture. And so I'd rather stick to this idea that somehow that came up, that somehow there's an autonomous technological push that you're saying, hey, we can do something about that. Some other people seem to be disagreeing. Yes?
I think it's there, but I think we're in the middle of a technological war. And that's the push. It's a new kind of war, and nobody yet's really getting killed except the people who are starving. But the war is who's got the one-upsmanship. You produce this, and then I'll produce that in response, and get a little further up, and it's back and forth, back and forth.
I'll throw one thing into you while you're thinking about this, in terms of where the push is, because we hear this idea of a technological imperative, and that part of that imperative is, they got it, therefore we have to have it, kind of, you know, the back and forth. But there's also a part that's internal to each one of the technological systems. And let me illustrate this, but I talked, and I was at a workshop a couple weeks ago when they were talking about the arms control negotiations. And the most difficult negotiations occur within each country. The people negotiating at the, you know, say Geneva, have a very small amount that they can say, and then they have to go back and internally argue. And a lot of the momentum for the technology on both sides occurs within the institutions of our country and the Soviet Union. I'm not saying that there may not be good reasons, external reasons, but a lot of that inertia is internal. And I'd like to get back at it. Do you think that that's something that we could exert some degree of control over?
In this light of technology and the Space Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, I'm not totally clear on it, but the philosophical thing that I've heard is that, of course, other countries have been, including Russia, have been invited in into the technological problems to create a Star Wars defense. And then when it is created, it's given to everybody so that everybody has it. Therefore, there's no reason that one has to mistrust the other. Should the accident happen, something goes up, there's a defense system built to stop it. There's no need to have to worry about your own, in this case, the Soviet Union, for instance. Don't have to worry about the United States backing, because it has the element of defense the same as the United States does. And well, this would seem to me to be a total shift in the direction of the use of technology.
Well,
but that's silly.
If it worked that way, I would say right now that the leading our technology on a defensive system is among the most secret technology now. I don't think that the research we're doing on defensive systems, there at least, you know, that may be pie in the sky dream that we can share it with them. Right now, I would say the secrecy there is extreme, you know, in terms of that. So, that would be kind of a hope, but I don't think that there, when I hear people who are for and against the Star Wars program, I really don't hear them saying, well, we're all going to share this and all make it. That might be a dream we have, but I don't think it's the reality now. Yeah.
Suppose that they designed a successful Star Wars system. They built it, and they shared it among all nations. What would be the very, considering human nature, what is going to be the very first thing that the scientists of these different nations are going to do when they get it? They're going to look at it and figure out how we can build an offensive system that's going to get around it.
That's probably true. In fact, the big argument the opponents of Star Wars are that it's easier to build an offensive system to get around it than to build a defensive system against it, against the new offense. So I can go into this. I'd like to stick to the general topic of what are the relationships of a citizenry, an independent citizenry, to the direction of technology. That's kind of the question that's coming up, because I'm hearing what you're saying is there seems to be this tremendous momentum of technology that happens, and the Soviets may have the same problem, and together we may have this problem. What is the role of the independent groups to discuss it? Yes.
When the gentleman there, Millet, mentioned to the notion that if the technology gets higher in one country, the other country is obviously going to do something to enhance their technology. And it seems we, the citizenry, could ask the question that doesn't seem to be asked popularly, and that is, to what ends are these means to meet? Is there ends to the mean, or is just means to a means to a means to a means? And I think we, the citizenry, should lock in on that maybe. You know, okay. I can't understand the technology. I never can. But I can understand the notion of different of the progress and how things go.
Okay. Let me paraphrase that. While you don't understand the details, the technical details of a particular technology, you as a citizen can say, okay, if you had it, what would you do with it? What is its purpose? And what are the consequences of having that?
And the ultimate end, you know, the ultimate.
And where is this all going?
End, yes, what is that?
I'm not sure what the ultimate end is, but where is this all going? Okay? For example, as we develop larger scale computer systems, okay, are we going to turn over the decisions to the computers? Okay? That's a question that ought to be asked. Okay? And certainly the moral implications of that, there are some rather significant ones that I think a citizenry ought to be concerned about. Now, you don't have to be a computer expert to deal with those kinds of questions. You can rely upon people who are to provide information who are very good at computers. But I think those kinds of questions are valid questions of a citizenry to ask. Okay? I think, you know, at least I think they are. Yes, somebody else had their hand. Yeah.
Another question that I think is related with this is the economic question that comes to mind. Now, I come from California, Southern California, and we depend very much on the industrial military complex for our own economic welfare. And I did see it go. I mean, most of my people lose their jobs. And, you know, I'm being very cynical at this point.
Right.
But I do think that is a factor, that this complex is big and it has to keep itself going. It seems to feed itself.
Right.
And somehow that is... And maybe there's others who know economics better than I do here, you know, in the field of economics, but it's a very costly process economic-wise as far as the use of both materials and the use of people as far as final productivity is concerned. In other words, there's other ways economically to be far more productive in a country than putting it into the military, from what I understand when I read. I think these are legitimate areas to at least question or challenge or look at. Maybe that's what President Eisenhower meant. It gets to a certain size and pretty soon, it's like the fires that hit LA, they begin to feed themselves and they cause their own world.
I think this was Eisenhower's concern, that it will become, we will become so much dependent upon it, and particularly the expertise that we think is necessary to even criticize it is dependent upon it, and then there's no one outside to raise the questions. I think, from what I've read of him, he was genuinely concerned about that. There is a group that I belong to, and I join a variety of different groups to get information on this. It's the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. And this is a new one to watch, though, because they are raising some very interesting questions. Questions that certainly ought to come in terms of the ethical dimensions, the moral dimensions. For example, if decisions are made, and they're talking not just about the Star Wars programs and nuclear, but a tank where there's nobody in it, artificial intelligence, the computer figures out who to shoot and all the rest of that. Where is the moral accountability in that? Does it get traced back to the people who made the computers? Does it get traced back to the people who figured out the computer code? There's thousands of people do that. Or are we creating systems where the question of moral accountability is irrelevant? You see what I mean? Now that's the kind of question that I think a citizenry can start raising. And the technical people who know the details quite often they're not well prepared to address those questions. Now, this group of Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, they're raising these questions. And there are people who, they're not divided on ideological lines. The ideological issues are, you know, they're not raising those, okay? I think most of the people, if you ask them, they'd say the Soviet Union is a totalitarian state and, you know, I wouldn't want to live there. Now let's get on with the issue of how we deal with this technology. They don't want to be diverted into the ideological rhetoric. And you're finding an awful lot of groups that are fed up with the ideological rhetoric. They want to deal with the issues, okay? And they don't particularly like the way the Soviet Union behaves, and that's not the issue for them. But one of the concerns that they had in one of their newsletters is that the issues will die because the very thing you've talked about, that the profession itself will become so dependent upon the military-industrial complex that there won't be that critical mass of people out there to sustain the kinds of questions independently. And the questions might not get raised. Mm. So that was one of the concerns that they had.
I think there's I work in a newspaper business on a small scale, but I deal with information. And, I guess I see a lot of despair out there right now about the average guy that kills himself to make a living for his family, loses his job on a limb of a contractor or something, and then reads about the billion-dollar tanks, running the weapons and so on and so forth, putting into the tanks and that are absolutely essential to the survival of this country, according to somebody.
And he's not.
And he's not going to make it.
And he's not essential.
And maybe it's fine that he believes that Allah or God or whoever else is going to take care of him in the end. But the thing is that he doesn't see why it has to be spent that way when his kids can't find a decent school, or when a lot of these sociological questions are not being dealt with in a country that's supposed to have everything. And I guess maybe he just throws his hands up and say, yeah, well, they must be right, because they have all the answers. Okay. And then you say, well, maybe we should raise these questions, but what's the point? I said, we don't have any muscle to do anything about it if we raise the question. Okay, the people that are in power are the ones that still decide whether or not the button's going to be pushed, or whether the money's going to be spent, whether there's any deception in how the money is spent or not, and whether we're even going to get the right information to possibly solve that problem, to make a rational judgment. We're assuming in a democratic government we have that opportunity to do that. But I think we're just about as bad shape as the Russians even having the power to make those kind of decisions. Or maybe we shouldn't be allowed to. Maybe that average citizen shouldn't be allowed to have any input into just whether or not this is a correct thing to do or not.
So let me see if I can touch on the feelings. No, but I'll touch on the feelings. The feeling of despair.
Yes.
Powerlessness, and an inability to let's just, maybe those two enough. Despair and powerlessness, and that despair and powerlessness produces a loss of hope, and in the loss of hope, people throw up their hands and say, "There's nothing I can do." Right? Is that what you're saying?
Okay. What bothers me is that I've reached the point where I can't trust any information you get from the government. If it makes the government look bad, they'll deny it, no matter what it is, it's a $10 million boo-boo or $100 million.
Okay, we've got a paradox here, and I think theologians are better at dealing with paradoxes than... We've got a paradox in the sense between these two. See if you can pick it up. I don't trust the information, and remember I said before, in order to produce trustworthy information, we need communities of people who raise questions and struggle with it. And they have to be outside the main system, not just the main system. They have to do that. However, this is becoming impossible to sustain because of the despair and the powerlessness and the sense of hopelessness. See, we've got two. See the connection between these two. Okay? We don't have the raising of the questions and the struggle with them. We get wrapped up in this ideological rhetoric. There's a tremendous amount of despair. There's a tremendous sense of powerlessness. And so we don't do anything. And so therefore there aren't these communities. And over time we reinforce the concept, gee, I don't know what to do. And that just adds to the despair, adds to the... You see the cycle where we get in? The cycle we get in? Okay, yeah.
Well, we have opportunities, for example, to elect congressmen and senators or representatives of armed services committees who do take the opportunity to raise these questions to the military about the utility of the weapons they're questioning. And I don't think it's a brother and sister love act necessarily at all between those committees and the armed services. And we as citizenry, of course, have an opportunity to evaluate the people who are candidates for those positions in government and Congress, to elect people who are responsible, who will in fact have some integrity and ask the appropriate questions. And they do have the appropriate clearances, so they can be told, of course, why we need X number of weapons, or why we need this type of weapon.
Well, I hear you saying one thing that's different from what I'm saying. You said, when you said, I was with you up until you said they have the appropriate clearances and therefore they can ask the questions, where we don't have the clearances and so we can't?
You could ask the questions. You could ask the questions of your senator, for example.
But what about within a group like this?
Well, to a certain level, obviously military information can be discussed, and another level it cannot be.
I'll put it this way. The most important questions, I don't think, have to deal with secret information. I don't think so. I think the technical details, quite often, you know, for example, on the triggering device of a hydrogen bomb, well, that may be highly secret information. And it probably should be. I just assume not have it out. But the destructiveness of the nuclear bomb is obvious to anyone. No one's debating that. And then the question of how should we as a society deal with that destructiveness is not restricted in any meaningful way by the secret information on the details of how you produce it. So I think there are a lot of things that we can discuss and we ought to discuss that... the secret information, too often I think secret information is a way people use to not have their decisions challenged. Now, there may be some valid reasons, there may not be. Somebody else had their hand up. Then I want to go back to these two issues that were raised here. Yes, Don.
I think the way citizenry can make itself felt on make an impact on the government in this way. In order to do this, we see techniques that, like Daniel Berrigan has done, and it's kind of beating your head against the wall. It's really done, it hasn't done that much, but I think if we look at the techniques that some of the environmental groups have used, and they have made quite an impact on the government. Say the Sierra Club, where they have lawyers, they have publications, they mount campaigns among their members and everybody, having them write to congressmen, telling them what to write, and these publicity campaigns, combined with the attacks of the lawyers, have made an impact on the government in a lot of cases, prevented them from logging certain areas and made wilderness areas and things like that. And it would seem to me that a lot of these techniques could be applied by a concerned citizenry to divert the government into more reasonable channels.
Mike?
Okay. The problem is, though, that the guys on these committees, you write to them and you can send them millions and millions of pieces of mail, and somebody in the military complex will give them $50,000 for their campaign. And that's what controls it, money, most of the time.
It's votes, though, ultimately.
Now, there is something here that we're doing I want to point out, because I want to get back to the theology of it, believe it or not, even though I'm an engineer. We're trying, we're having this debate, in one sense, can we solve the problem or can we not? Okay, that's kind of the way. Where you're saying, giving an example, here's a way we could get a solution to the problem, and then you kind of shoot him down on that solution of the problem, and then you say, see, there's the despair. Okay, you notice the reaction. Okay, you notice. Okay, you see that? So one says, here's a solution. The other one shoots it down, and they said, there's no hope. Okay, do you get the connection? Now, here's the connection. How many have taken some courses in engineering? Anybody here? Okay, you remember, have you taken statics? Remember the course statics? Okay, did you take statics, Don?
No.
Okay, statics is a sophomore level course. And correct me if I'm wrong, you're given a lot of problems to solve in that course, right?
That's basically, I think they dump quite a few of those.
Quite a few of those, and believe me, that's an understatement, right? Continually problems, right? Okay, now, what happens to you if you can't solve the problem? If you can't solve the problems?
TA.
Huh?
You got your TA today.
No, you're a student. You can't, you're given the problem. You can't solve it. What do they tell you?
One of the ways, if you can't solve that, you do get amongst others in your peer group, okay, and you find out how they solved it.
And if you can't solve it, like on the test?
If the group can't solve it, then maybe at that time then it goes back to the originator, a professor, a TA.
But if you don't solve problems, what happens to you?
Oh, basically that student finally disappears.
That's right. Okay, you got the message. Okay. Okay, now you see that.
You're going through class, you start right out with 90, next thing you know there's 60.
That's right.
Then there's 30. They get clear to the end, there's about 15 left.
Okay, well, the attrition might not be that, but the message, let's get the basic message. The basic message, here's the problems. If you don't solve them, you usually got about an hour to solve on the average, you know. You fail, right? There is no hope. Notice the connection. First, there's a problem. Question, is there a solution? Do you have a solution? If the answer is no, you fail. There's no hope. Okay, now that is a condensed dose of what everybody gets in a technological society. That's our technological background, that hope comes from solving problems. Right? Is that good theology? No. Okay? What do we have? Is that where we get our hope from, solving problems? What's the theology of grace say?
Hey, we've been given the answer.
We're given, well, did we given the answer? Remember what Vespers last night? We're not given the answer. There is no answer. Remember we said? Remember it was, there is no answer. Jesus says, there is no answer and I am it. Wasn't that great? There is no answer. I don't give you the answers. Does that mean there is no hope? If in a statics class, yes. If you don't have the answer, there is no hope. Right? There is no hope. But are we going to accept the technological way of thinking for our lives?
No.
Okay? Now, what Elmer had last night in the Vespers. There is no answer. There is hope. Let's celebrate. Did he sound pessimistic when he gave that service?
No way.
No way! He sounded hopeful. And he kept telling you there are no answers. Now, if he was in a statics class, he'd be crazy. They'd carry him away. But he wasn't in a statics class. Right? You agree with that? He wasn't. Yeah, that's for sure. We know that for sure. Okay? But you see, what we have done is we've bought into the technological idea that problem comes first, then solution, then hope. It seems to me that what Elmer's telling us and what we've been told is it goes the other way around. Okay? You get hope. It's a gift, a freely given gift, right? Accept it. Now get on with the world out there. And you can be hopeful, okay? Not because you have the answers, right? But in spite of the fact that you don't. But what we've done is we've bought in to a technological way of thinking too much. Now in a statics class, you better buy into it, or you won't make it, that's true. But what we're talking about is something much more than that. Okay? What we're talking about is more than that. A more fundamental way of living. Okay? Where hope is given to us as a freely given gift, and then God says, now get on and do something, not because you're going to be right, but in spite of the fact that you'll probably be wrong. In spite of the fact that it might not work. Okay? Now, you might say, well, gee, that's nice to say at Holden Village. Okay? That's really nice to say. But what do you say on the outside? Well, that's a good question. It's hard to say those things on the outside. It really is. I'll tell you a story. I was in a class, and we were discussing, engineering class, and we're discussing the problems, environmental problems, we're discussing all the rest of this, and the depression the students were subtitling the course Gloom and Doom, okay? You know, they give these subtitles to the courses. Gloom and Doom, 301 or whatever it was. And people were really getting depressed. Cynical. You've been in classes where that happens, right? Mm-hmm. Right. This is the cynicism. And you begin to wonder what your role is, why you're doing that class. You begin to wonder, why am I teaching? Is my, you know, the biggest thing I'm accomplishing here is producing cynics. Why? Is that something you want to do as a teacher? Okay? And I mean unhealthy cynics. I don't mean people who are just critical. I mean people who just want to give up. That kind, that deep cynicism. Deep cynicism. Okay? So I tried several things as a teacher, and those of you who are teachers and preachers know there's a lot of things you can do to try to avoid that. One of the things is you cut off the message. Right? You say, oh, these students are feeling cynical, so then what you try to do is talk in a positive way, and they get the message they better not look cynical. And they better not ask those cynical questions, right? I mean, ministers can do this, teachers can do this, you can cut off the feedback. Or what you can do is avoid all the big questions, okay? I can deal with designing sewage treatment plans. We all know how to do that. Okay, isn't that great? I can make them hopeful then. Of course, unfortunately, they're solving all the little problems. And they're avoiding all the big ones. But we do that, right? That's one way of avoiding this negative attitude. So I tried that. These are bright students. And I got the message that they knew what I was doing. You know, I got the message was the silence. The question stopped. You've been in classes like that, you know. But everybody takes their notes. And like that Doonesbury, remember? Everybody takes their notes. Oh, yeah. We know the game now. We got the game now, the silence says. We're supposed to take it down, feed it back to you. You give us the A, hopefully. And we go on to the next one, and we'll forget about all this stuff. Anyhow, we got the game. We're good at it. That's the message. And I could tell it was the message. And so one day, you know, I sat down in front of the class. I stopped right in the middle of the lecture, sat down in front of the class, which is a message all in itself. It's a message you're giving up power, right? And I didn't know what to say to him. Because I sensed this powerlessness and this hopelessness. What kind of information can we believe? And somehow we were trapped in this thing we had ever since statics and before. You got to come up with a solution or there's no hope. And how could I tell them about grace? And did I really believe it myself if I couldn't tell it in some place other than Holden Village? Right? I mean, if I can't say it at someplace else. And then, I don't know how it happened. I just said to them, okay. I don't know. And is there something you can do? I asked. Oh, yeah, there's stuff. We know that. And these are bright kids. They know there's something they can do. But it won't make a big, you know, all that stuff. Stop. Is there something you can do? Just say to yourself, in your mind, something. So, yeah, they kind of looked back, that disgusted look at me. And then I said, okay, tell yourself there's something you can do. Okay? Now say to yourself, but it won't make a bit of difference. There was a new silence. Silence that says, now he's being honest. Then I said, now say to yourself, and I may be wrong. Now say to yourself, I may even get in trouble. Now say to yourself, but I'm going to do it anyway. You feel a smile? That's the gift of grace. And I said to them, if you remember one thing from this class, remember the smile. They accepted that answer. They accepted that answer. Basically, we are called to deal with these problems, not because we have all these nice solutions, but in spite of the fact that we don't. And that is something to smile about. And that's why Elmer Witt can give a joyful sermon out there. I won't even call it a sermon, an experience out there. And tell us that we don't have the answers to all of these things. And we can all celebrate and then get out and do something. That's the craziness of the concept of grace. And that's the craziness of that smile when I said, do it anyhow. Okay? They could accept the smile. That was the answer. And they could accept that. That's the theology of grace. And I think we've got to learn more about that if we ever want to have hope in the nuclear age. Because we're not going to get the hope from coming up with nice solutions. What we're going to do is get the hope, and that's going to give us the freedom to struggle with the problem. Maybe we'll come up with solutions, maybe not. Okay, the bell's rung, so if you want to run to get up to the first setting, go ahead. Thank you.